The first day of school, the first day on the job is a stressful experience, no doubt. There are lots of strange faces, lots of anxiety, lots of self-doubt about fitting in, about becoming a member of the new team. Now add to that equation, you are the only black face among hundreds of white ones. That's the story of a new film, The Prep School Negro.
I grew up in the ghettos of Philadelphia. When I was 14, I got a scholarship to attend a prestigious private prep school.
That school just took my brother away from me, and that's not my brother, that's somebody else. I mean, his talk is different, his walk is different.
In this community, I'm considered real black. In another community, you know, in my neighborhood, I'm considered a white boy. I go to private school.
The voice at the start of that clip belongs to Andre Robert Lee. He's a kid from a lower middle class, tough inner city neighborhood in Philadelphia who got the chance to attend the prestigious Germantown Friends Prep School in Philadelphia. His film looks at what it's like to be alone in a crowd. Andre Robert Lee, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Good morning.
You started at Germantown Friends School when you were 14 years old. Prior to that, you had attended schools where most, if not all, of the students were black. What was that first day of school like?
The first day of school, it was like one of the kids in the film describes it very well. She says it's like jumping in cold water. You know, it's very shocking. It was also very exciting. You know, I came to the school that was a world that I had never imagined, didn't know about, that was within walking distance from my house.
Mm-hmm. Before you got to school, did you know what to expect? Did you have a good idea what it was going to be like? There had to have been some anxiety. It's always anxiety when you go to a new school.
Yeah, yeah.
But you had the added element. I mean,
I often say for any child, the first day of school or a brand new school is a horrific experience.
Yes.
For me, I was a bit excited. You know, we had summer reading, and I had never heard the phrase summer reading. I thought that's an oxymoron. Summer reading. What are you going to do? And our books were Our books were Sula by Toni Morrison, Mary Renault's The King Must Die, and The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck. So I walked in thinking, like, okay, let's talk about these books. What are we going to do? And I was excited about a community that I thought that would get me and understand me for the first time.
Uh-huh. Did that happen?
A little bit. The great thing about, I think, Germantown Friends School is a Quaker school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the things I heard the first day in there is that we look for the good in every person. We believe there's God in every person. And I walked in thinking, okay, they're looking for the good in me, so let's see if we can find it in each other.
Mm-hmm. We ask you to join our conversation. We are particularly interested in hearing from people who found themselves the minority in a certain situation, whether it be a school or a new job where you were the only member of your race. Perhaps you're the only woman in an all-male environment, the only male in an all-woman environment. If you found yourself being one among many, give us a call at 292-9678 or drop us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Andre Robert Lee, how did you come to go to Germantown Friends School?
Yeah, that's a great question. I went there through the summer basketball reading clinic. Mm-hmm. David Felsen started this clinic a number of years ago, and the idea was to get kids from the community to come onto the campus in the summer and do a basketball summer reading clinic. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have a wicked jump shot, but I'm a great reader. And I think folks found me to be a great reader.
And just in the film, you see that they almost stop the game and they ask you a question, a vocabulary question or an academic question. Yeah. And if you got it right, you got a couple points, right?
It was called the word of the day. Uh-huh. And that was my first time being an important member of a basketball team ever. People used to fight over me.
So you had the point guard, but you had the word guard.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
Anyway, continue. That's how you were introduced to the school.
That's how I was introduced. But I've found, you know, I was asked that same question at Germantown Friends School when I went to visit. And I found that there's another backstory I didn't really know about. After making this film and doing some research, I found that my mother had a therapist, which none of us knew about. She was secretly seeing a therapist, which is a big deal in the African-American community for people to reach out for therapy, for one. And then the fact that it was secret, I called this guy up, you know, and I said, hey, I'm Andre Robert Lee. And he goes, oh, I know you. You worked at the Ford Foundation. You worked at Miramax, even East Village. And I was like, and you are? And it turns out this guy, his name is Stephen Rook, he knew a lot about my mother because he said my mother walked into his office and she couldn't say Germantown Friends School, but she could say my boy needs something else. And so through the two of them talking over years, he suggested the basketball reading clinic with the thought, because once you're in the clinic, they observe potential students for
the future.
Kind
of tryout.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you were given a scholarship, and you went to the school.
Yes.
How many other African-American students were there when you were there?
I think the number in the school, the total population was about somewhere between 7 and 10%. Mm-hmm. You know, in my particular class, a class of that started out my freshman year to be about 85, and by graduation it was 69, there were 7.5 we used to joke about. There was one kid who's biracial, and he's went along with the joke.
So you weren't alone, but you were virtually alone, because probably many of your individual classes, you were the only African-American in that classroom, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that isolation comes along in many different facets, which most children face. But what I find from the perspective of the prep school Negro, as I like to describe it nowadays, is that it's an exaggerated moment of isolation, because you're in a school and all children trying to figure out who they are and figure out who to date, where to eat, where to sit, all kinds of stuff. But when you are... there's a majority group, there are a number of X's, and those X's function and live and eat and drink in the same way, and you come in and you're an O that doesn't really fit into that equation. It's a matter of fitting in and trying to find your particular path and groove and space within it.
Mm-hmm. I gave the wrong phone number a moment ago. The receptionist at the front desk hates me now, but the number to call to get to on the air is 292-8513, 292-8513, to join our discussion with Andre Robert Lee. He's the filmmaker who made the film The Prep School Negro. It talks about his experiences of being one of just a couple of African-Americans in a prestigious East Coast prep school. What was your strategy for fitting in?
My strategy for fitting in? Luckily, I'm kind of an odd person, and I'm interested in different types of people and interested in finding out what they're about, and I'm nosy. So my strategy really was to walk in with an open heart and an open mind and trying to figure out and learn and listen and listen to what was going on in the environment and see how I could fit into that world. And so the strategy, I don't know if I had a strategy when I walked into the school, you know, because you're 14.
Yeah.
You just want to make it through lunch, you know. And without this, luckily I had some support from a few teachers. There weren't enough, which is part of my mission and my discussion is, like, you know, getting more people of color on staff in the school who the children can look to and recognize as leaders and friends and allies and professionals and et cetera. So it's hard to say what was my strategy. You know, I luckily had some sort of resilience inside of me to make it through what could be a very tough environment at times.
Did you feel the pressure to become less African American, if I could use that term?
Yeah, that you know, it's interesting. I've been influenced by a woman by the name of Catherine Watson, who's working on a book entitled "There's No Such Thing as a Black Experience," and this is a message I've been giving to children, because when you put that pressure on someone to say you're not black because you don't, you're not Latino because you don't, you're not Jewish because you don't, I think that's a mistake that we often make in our society. And my thoughts, I'm actually going to a school in Dallas next Friday, a school that was really resistant to having me, but all of a sudden is interested. I'm giving a talk that is called exactly that. There's no such thing as a black experience. And the whole idea is that, you know, every culture has varied levels of people, peoples and their ideas and practices and ways of walking, talking. And we often, I think, it's our own projection of our insecurities, put it on people and say, well, you're not enough of this or that. Now, having said all of that, I didn't have this type of thinking when I went to the high school. And I went into the high school thinking, oh, my family is lower income and black. These people are white and successful. I need to become more like them. And that's the error and the mistake that I made, and didn't have anyone to stop me and say, wait a minute, slow down, young man. Who you are is enough, and you are good. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that kind of support to help me make it through those things.
What kind of things did you find yourself doing?
You know, it's funny. I remember the moment I brought the Beatles home, and I played the Beatles, and my mother was like, oh, Lord, that's the devil's music. You know, she was freaking out.
A lot of white parents thought that, too. Maybe not in the 1980s, but certainly in the 60s and 70s.
Exactly. So, it's the kind of thing – one doesn't notice when the timbre of one's voice changes, you know, because when you're around people that speak a certain way, you start picking up their patterns in speech, their tones, their inclinations. I start saying like every like other like word, you know, and no one in my neighborhood spoke that way. So I think I just became conditioned by the environment that I was a part of, because I was there all the day, and I was so excited about the environment. So the ways that I began to switch and change, I think, related to my approach, the way I dressed, you know, it was a whole different neighborhood. It's kind of funny because there's a return back to that 80s preppy look, which is really kind of out of control. But there were a number of different ways that I sort of adapted and came into the space.
There's a clip in the movie in which you mention your dress, and I think we have that right now. Let's listen to it.
Okay.
My entire world was one type of person, one type of black person, you know, one lower income sort of black people. That was it.
There's no way we were really aware of that.
I used to change my clothes on my bus ride home.
Our awareness of all that, I think, was somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. And we knew it was a transition that was difficult, but
yeah,
it's also a big factor in trying to...
It's huge. Make-
That's you, Andre, speaking to one of your teachers.
To David Felsen.
You used to change your clothes on the bus ride home. Why?
Yeah. Because the kids in my neighborhood made fun of me. You know, I had sabagos were a big thing back then, and they were these terribly ugly boat shoes, which are very popular now, but mm-hmm. that was the fashion in my school. Mm-hmm. And in my neighborhood, it was like, what are you doing
wearing those? Those are the boat shoes with the white soles?
No, those are topsiders.
Okay.
These sabagos are a whole nother beast, you know.
I've forgotten my prep school shoes.
Come on, pull together, man. It's a whole nother beast.
Okay.
So in my neighborhood, you know, folks would make fun of me for those shoes, mm-hmm. so I would literally put them in my bag mm-hmm. and put on my sneakers that fit around the way. Now, at school, I had there's a rap artist by the name of Biggie Smalls. He has a song called Back in the Day, mm-hmm. and he has this line about, I used to wear the lumberjack and the hat to match, and it was just, in my neighborhood, this really hot outfit. You know, it was a blue and black jacket with a fur collar and around the hood and this hat that matched like a Charlie Brown hat.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine a whole outfit like that. Now, in my school, folks were like, dude, what are you wearing? You know, and in my neighborhood, they were like, wow, you look awesome. You look hot, man. And so it's this moment of like, well, who's right? And how's a kid feel when you're trying to socialize,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was already becoming disconnected from my neighborhood because I had 4 or 5 hours of homework a night,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't exactly outside playing with the folks I used to play with all my life.
You mentioned in the film that you went home and you practiced how to say the word ask, because
yeah.
the dialects in the African-American community often is mispronounced as axe.
Mm-hmm.
Describe the pressure to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll push back a little bit on mm-hmm. us calling it mispronouncing it.
Okay.
Because that's something we have to think about. Yes, there's a proper and standard way mm-hmm. to speak it and say it, and we know the correct way mm-hmm. is to say ask,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the message I heard was that you're mispronouncing by saying X, and
uh-huh.
that right there went to you're dumb, you're stupid, you're less.
Uh-huh.
I just came from North Carolina, you know, where the dialect is very different, and I've had many talks with folks from down there who say when they come up north, people instantly assume they're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't deny the truth about proper English,
mm-hmm.
but I did fall into a bit of a trap in high school or thinking the way I spoke define me as less and stupid and I'll never achieve anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I had someone, really, the message I'm really trying to communicate is to say, like, wait a minute, the way you speak and what you know, it isn't the proper way, but it mm-hmm. doesn't make you less than others in the community and our society. Because I think that is a systemic mm-hmm. Sort of situation and approach that's out there. And it's a matter of teaching kids, like, wait a minute, you need to know how to say ask and use words properly in order to succeed in our society. But you also need to know that where you come from and how you speak doesn't make you less.
292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. We're speaking with Andre Robert Lee. He's a filmmaker, originally from Philadelphia, now lives in New York City. The name of his film is The Prep School Negro. It talks about his experience as being one of a very few African-Americans in an elite East Coast prep school. What stereotypes did you break down for your white classmates?
I wish I had one here to tell us that. I think, you know, I met a number of people who had never spent much time with a person of color and talking to them. And I believe some of the stereotypes that I broke down for them within the community was related to the day-to-day experience, you know, of just fear. You know, I had one friend who used to drive me home, and she used to give me a ride. And it literally, we learned this in geometry class, the shortest distance between A and B is a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't go through, like the school was point A, her house was point B. And she could stop in the middle of that line and go to my house, but instead she would go way out on a 45-degree angle to go to point C, I guess you would say, or whatever. Forgive me, geometry teachers. But she would go out of her way to avoid my neighborhood. And it was a matter of seeing my neighborhood as scary and horrific, and she'll be pulled out of a car and killed. You know, and I finally was like, you know, why don't you drop me at my house? You know, why do you take this extra route? And she was like, well, you know, I'm a little afraid, and I don't know what's going to happen. And I was like, I said, you deal with me every day, and I'm from there. Mm-hmm. You know, am I scary or horrific? You know, what's that about? And so I think for some kids, what some things that happened was, in general, when you're exposed to difference, it's when you begin to see that, you know what, this isn't so horrific or frightening. It's a lot less dangerous than I imagine. And I hope and believe some of the stereotypes that I broke down were around the lack of exposure, related to the lack of exposure and knowledge about individual people.
Just, we're all human.
Yeah, exactly.
Underneath, and
exactly.
I think that's, unless you, if you're only watching The Cosby Show,
right.
That's not human.
Exactly.
Which is what, that was the hit show at the time you were there.
Right, right.
We're speaking with Andre Robert Lee. He is the filmmaker of the film The Prep School Negro. It's being shown here in Central Ohio tonight at the Wellington School. And when we return, we'll speak to the head of the Wellington School and an alum of the school, an African-American alum, and talk about their experiences when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. And get access to 89.7 NPR News anytime online at WOSU.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day, from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime online at WOSU.org.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.
And it's 46 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a high of 63. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 47. Clouds for Thursday and a high of 65. And rain moves into the area Thursday night. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the experience of being alone in a crowd, the experience of being an African-American in a largely all-white prep school, an all-white environment. Our guest is Andre Robert Lee. He is the producer of the film The Prep School Negro. Talks about his experience as being one of only a very few African-Americans at a prep school in Philadelphia. Joining us on the line is Jacob Robinson. He is a graduate, a 2010 graduate of the Wellington School in Upper Arlington, and he is now a freshman at Duke University in North Carolina. Jacob, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, how are you doing?
You were among a few at the Wellington School. What was your experience like at that school?
I feel like Wellington was a very diverse place. There were not a large number of African-American students, but there were a large number of students of color. Through that, I was exposed to a number of different cultures and lifestyles that I would not have been exposed to if it was an all-white or an all-black environment. But I do think that Wellington strives for diversity and is making progress with that.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, when did you start at the Wellington School?
I started as a sixth grader from mm-hmm. Wellington. I attended Indianola Alternative Elementary School mm-hmm. in Columbus Public from kindergarten to fifth grade. And my parents just wanted the best opportunity for me going into middle school and high school, and Wellington was the best fit.
Mm-hmm. Now, Columbus City Schools, much larger African-American population than you had at the Wellington School. Did you feel like you had to change when you went to the Wellington School? Did you resist the change? What was your experience like?
Yeah, I think, you know, having me speak is a slight contrast to Mr. Lee's experience. Obviously, we share a similarity with race, but I do feel like there's a slight difference in socioeconomic background. And I think that this is very important because it emphasizes the shared experience of African Americans regardless of where you come from. In that, coming from Columbus Public Schools and a middle-class background and being an African-American, I guess I just kind of had a thought in my mind that Wellington would be, you know, elitist and possibly racist before I even stepped in the doors. I would like to emphasize that it was a complete opposite of how my experience ended up being. Mm-hmm. But in a sixth grader's mind, and I guess what I had seen on TV about private school mm-hmm. and what I experienced in Columbus, this is how I felt. And the way that I dealt with this in the mind of a sixth grader was, you know, I thought, okay, they may think, you know, low of me because I'm African American, and they may not think as highly as me because I'm from a middle class background. I responded to that, and I'm going to try to be the best in everything that I do at Wellington, so that I demand respect. Inside the classroom, outside the classroom, I wanted to be involved in as many different activities as possible. And I wanted to be the best by getting straight A's, being a great athlete, being a great musician, having strong handwriting, perfect handwriting, just trying to be the best in everything that I could do, so I could show everyone around me that I was equal, if not better.
Were there any tensions at home? We talked about, you know, being less black, to use that term, as odd as it is. I mean, did you feel that tension at home when you were trying to do these things at a largely white school?
Not at all. I think, you know, with that shared experience that I have with Mr. Lee, that was something that was more at school, where I felt like, you know, I may have to change or act black or act white. You know, one thing that I struggled with was I didn't want to seem too black or ghetto at school just because I was African American. My parents are both college graduates from Oberlin College. Like, my dad lives with me and was a part of my life. Mm-hmm. And I understand that is not the experience of many African Americans in the United States. And I mean, through the media and other, you know, means of communication, America sees this as the black experience, and they see this as acting black. You have to be ghetto. You have to be a gangster. You can't excel in school. And for me, I was kind of caught in between, because I was like, that's not my life. Like, I'm not familiar with that. And I just want to be able to be myself and reach my full potential.
Andre Robert Lee, the filmmaker, is nodding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
vigorously.
I am Jacob Hayes. It's nice to meet you over the phone. I was just in your North Carolina last night. I'm glad to hear you say that the issue of the varied experience. You know, one thing I did in the film was I spent time with four children, and two of them were recipients of scholarships and two were not. And I intentionally didn't define which were and which were not received the scholarship, because, as you stressed, the idea is that there are very similar experiences while they are very varied. And our stories are very individual and very different, which is part of my whole platform of this idea of there's no such thing as a black experience. There's mm-hmm. experience of being black. And you know, some things you're saying that I'm here, and the reason I was nodding, and part of the reason why I made this film, is how many teachers are sitting here thinking, a sixth grader is sitting here thinking, I have to have perfect penmanship to fit into this environment. And you know, that's a lot of pressure to put yourself as a sixth grader. You know, I have to be the best in school. I have to be at the top of the list, because I want to prove that I'm not less because I'm African American. My thought is, I want to get right into that moment right there with any child that's experiencing that and say, okay, let's stop for a second and say, wait a minute, you are enough. You know, it's important to prove and excel and do well, but you really need to know that you are enough, mm-hmm. because there's some damage that comes about from that type of experience. There are lots of benefits. I believe in that, and it sounds like you're doing very well. You're at Duke. My friends from UNC Chapel Hill would have speak differently, but we won't go there today. But I think that one of my big messages is that often when you go down that path, you fall into what I've often called the psychological homelessness. Mm-hmm. Because you are on these paths to prove, and it's like, let's let the child step back and be a kid in the school and really feel that they belong here and they are enough for the environment.
We're talking about the experiences of being an African-American in a largely all-white prep school environment on all sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. 292-8513, if you have a question. We're particularly interested in hearing from folks who found themselves in a similar situation, whether you were the only person of your race in an all-white environment or you're the only woman in an all-male environment. Give us a call, 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. One more question, then we'll bring in the head of the Wellington School for both Andre and Jacob. Andre, the different eras. You went to the prep school in the mid-'80s. Wasn't the 60s, but it still was closer to the civil rights movement than Jacob found himself at the Wellington School. How much can we look at the difference in the eras and how African Americans are viewed, how diversity and inclusion is viewed in these schools?
That's a great question. The program that I went to, Germantown Friends School, on was called the Community Scholars Program. And something happened that no one seemed to know how it changed and when it shifted. When I was there, it somehow became the Community Scholarship Program. And there was a group that helped start the Community Scholars Program back in the 60s who stepped forward and said, wait a minute. We don't want it called a scholarship. We want them to call it scholars because that's how we look at them. It's how they thought about it in this environment. You know, I always joke and say it was the Reaganomics era, you know, and money was really important and big. And we entered feeling like we were taking something away from someone else with the scholarship notion versus we were scholars that belong here and we're a part of this community. So the changes that I see in terms of the experiences, you know, it's changed a great deal now. When I meet younger people like Jacob and other kids who've gone to schools recently, their experience is very different and also very similar at the same time. So I think the general issues still exist, but I'm happy to see much more progress. For one, you see a number of middle-class families, you know, that are the results of some private schools and education and the access to education, which is a really great movement in our society. But it brings about a whole new set of issues because these folks are still feeling they need to prove that they fit in to the environment.
Jacob, do you feel folks like Andre and folks who sort of are sort of laid the groundwork for you to attend a school like Wellington and made perhaps a little bit easier for you to fit in?
Most definitely. You know, not only those who attended private school, but also those who have came before us and fought for education, you know, equality in general. And, I would just like to add that, you know, through this we can see that, you know, race is a socially constructed, you know, factor. Over time, you know, a perception on a race or any other characteristic can change. And, you know, we're seeing that, you know, progressively through time. And the only thing that's changing that is exposure. As a personal example, I had not been exposed to many homosexuals before I came to college. But I had a good friend of mine who was a friend before I knew he was gay. And after finding out that he was gay, I found it very difficult to be like, well, I haven't been very exposed to homosexuality, but I can't sit here and say because this person is gay, I'm not going to be their friend. And I feel like in the same sense with race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, ability, or anything else, although those are things that we can see immediately, you have to be exposed to things in order to understand them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in classes, for example, I'm in a sociology class with Professor Bonilla Silva, and he has a book called Racism Without Racist, and he talks about how the individuals in society aren't racist. White Americans aren't all members of the Ku Klux Klan, but there is white privilege that whites take advantage of, whether they like it or not. When you walk into a room, you don't have to prove yourself if you're white. When you're an African American, that's something that you have to do. When you walk into a shopping mall, you're not followed if you're white. You are if you're African American. So I mean, these are not individuals that are the problem. This is society, and these are groups. And the only way that we will continue to progress in history is if we expose people to differences and slowly start to change how society perceives these things rather than how it has been in the past.
292-8513 is our phone number here on 89.7 NPR News. All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our guests, that voice you just heard is Jacob Robinson. He's a 2010 graduate of the Wellington School in Upper Arlington. Andre Robert Lee, a filmmaker who has made the film The Prep School Negro. And Robert Brisk, he is the head of the Wellington School in Upper Arlington. Robert, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. And I want to say hello to Jacob. Hi, Jacob.
How are you doing?
Doing fine, thank you.
You guys know each other.
Yes,
the Wellington School, right there on your website, says we embrace diversity. What is the makeup of your student body?
Well, we're diverse in all sorts of ways. And if the particular thing you're interested in is African-American students, we're about 20% African-American. Uh-huh. But we are well-rounded in pretty much every kind of descriptor that one could think of. I think one of the things that makes Wellington a little bit different from Germantown, friends, is that we were founded about 30 years ago, mm-hmm. And that we were founded by a group of Columbus entrepreneurs who were really looking to build an education that was academically excellent, but that looked a little bit different from other schools, and diversity and inclusion was something that was really present at the very beginning of the school. So you don't have the experience when you walk through Wellington of 100 years of pictures of graduating mm-hmm. classes with no African Americans. You have really from day one an emphasis on inclusivity and diversity. And I think it's one of the things that has been a hallmark for our school and has been really important for us.
So you didn't have to deal with, it's the prep school history where, diversity was a focus of the Wellington School from the get-go. You didn't have to change alumni's minds that diversity is a good thing to have at a school.
Exactly. In our first graduating class, there are African-American students that very early in the history of the school, there were African-American trustees and faculty members. So those were issues that really we were in a better starting point than many schools like Germantown, friends.
But the tuition at the Wellington School is between $16,000 and $19,000 a year. How hard is it to get a diverse student body when it's expensive to go there?
Well, if we're talking about socioeconomic diversity, the school really aims towards goals around socioeconomic diversity by assisting families through financial aid and scholarship mm-hmm. who demonstrate need. Mm-hmm. And we work very hard in that regard. And we do think that socioeconomic diversity is really a significant and important piece of what mm-hmm. we do.
You have to be vigilant, though, to make sure that you do have that diversity. What kind of steps do you take, aside from the aid, to make sure that you're getting African-Americans, Asian-Americans, Hispanics, even folks from lower-income white neighborhoods to come to your school?
Well, I think the thing that we do and that we work the hardest to do is to put out in the community what our mission is. And that we attract, really the thing that we are trying to do is to attract families that really believe in the school's mission. And our mission is really about the unique potential of every student. It is key to us that we are helping every student find his or her path. And so in our curriculum, the programs that we are known for are independent science research that starts in sixth grade, in which every student does his or her own independent research. In our English classes, we have playwriting opportunities throughout in which our students are recognized for their playwriting. In history, we have students who we have a significant emphasis on oral history. In all regards, what we're trying to do is to give students opportunities to become who they are going to become. Mm-hmm. We're not particularly interested in one Wellington stamp that all students should look and sound alike. We're really looking to develop every student. And the more we are out there with the work that we do, the more we attract students from all different backgrounds to come to join us.
How about your faculty and administration and staff? How diverse is that?
We are challenged in continuing to grow the diversity of our faculty and staff. It's something that we continue to work on. We have at various points, we continue to reach out and are looking for ways to attract people from communities that have not been represented in independent schools, largely, that include long conversations with local African-American churches, that include work with the diversity networks throughout the nation. That's constant work that we do at the school.
Okay, we're speaking about the challenges of being the only member of a race in an all-white prep school, and also the challenges of attracting a diverse workforce and a diverse student body to those schools and other organizations. We'll continue our conversation when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Supporting 89.7 NPR News is easier than ever when you become a sustaining member. Sign up online at wosu.org/sustainer. As a sustaining member, your donation is automatic, monthly, and ongoing. No more letters in the mail, and your WOSU member card will renew automatically. Every year, we'll confirm your membership, and you can cancel at any time. For as little as $5 per month, you'll be supporting the programs you love. Become a sustaining member now at wosu.org/sustainer.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's a conversation with NPR Senior Editor for Diversity, Luis Clemens, about strengthening NPR's news coverage by building a foundation of diverse experts and sources. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11. ArtZine is WOSU's arts and culture news magazine, featuring highlights of some of the best artists and groups in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/ArtZine and watch videos, stories about everything from CATCO to the Wexner Center to the Columbus Museum of Art and much more. Find out what's going on in the arts in Columbus at WOSU.org/ArtZine. Currently 46 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a few clouds, a high of 63, cloudy skies tonight and a low of 47. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the experience of being one of only a handful of African Americans in a largely white elite prep school. Our guests, Robert Brisk, he's the head of the Wellington School here in the Columbus area in Upper Arlington. Jacob Robinson, who is a 2010 graduate of the Wellington School, now a freshman at Duke University in North Carolina, and Andre Robert Lee, the maker of the film The Prep School Negro, which will be shown to students at the Wellington School today and will be shown to the public tonight. The Wellington School is on Reed Road in Upper Arlington. The public showing will be at 6:30 tonight. The school asks, though, if you plan to attend, to go on their website and register. It is free, but they're asking just so they can get a head count that that you register ahead of time. Robert Brisk, why are you showing this film?
Well, I think some of the conversation that we've heard with Andre and Jacob is exactly the kind of conversation that we wish to be generating in our schools. I think one of the things that was really exciting for us was that we did a screening for a small number of for Andre's film several months ago, and the reactions from the parents, and we also had students and faculty in that screening, was profound and interesting. And we really do believe that part of our mission is to create a safe environment for discussions of issues that are not necessarily comfortable. I think the other issue for us is that we believe very strongly in partnering not just with our students, but with our parents as well, and to get that conversation going among the adult community is every bit as important. And the idea of bringing this film came to us from a parent and a staff member who had become aware of the film and really felt that it was a great starting point, a great jumping off point for discussions about the strengths and challenges of Wellington and our community.
Let's go to the phones. 292-8513 is the number if you'd like to join in our conversation here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Dana, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to really say thank you to Andre for bringing this movie, bringing this documentary to light, because certainly the title and the experience really resonated with me. Like you, I'm a prep school graduate of the mid-1980s. I attended a private all-girls day school in Pittsburgh, the Ellis School. And it was really, it was by and large, you know, looking back, certainly I would say it was a wonderful experience, the exposure, the education, but it was also a huge, huge culture shock. I attended the school on a scholarship program, so, attending the school otherwise would have been far beyond my family's financial means, and I had five brothers and sisters, and we were certainly the first generation in our family to be able to attend college.
Dan, are you African American?
I am.
You are, okay.
I am. And it sort of, you know, as I say, it was a culture shock. There were two other African American girls in my high school graduating class. It was a very small class of 29 girls. But I can remember so well experiences like sitting in sort of like the waiting area of our day school and looking at old yearbook photos, and where that would be a moment where people are sort of laughing at the hairdos and looking at, you know, the eyeglasses and things like that. Mm-hmm. I was looking at how staff were named. And one of the first things that I noticed was that all of the white staff in the school were Mrs. So-and-so and Mr. What your name is. Mm-hmm. However, the African-American staff were Jim, mm-hmm. Sarah, you know, and certainly all of them were in the capacity of cook or, you know, groundskeeper and this type of thing. Interestingly enough, I have my oldest sister is about 10 years older than me, and she applied for admission to the school, and it would have been, you know, in the late 60s or early 70s. And, you know, at that time, the school was not as progressive as it was when I made application to the school, because she was not admitted, and her grades were every bit as good as mine. They were just sort of in a different place.
Well, Dana, we want to get our guest reaction to your comments, but thanks sure. very much for the call, Andre. Did you see a similar experience when you looked at the yearbooks and the faculty rosters?
Yeah, Dana, thank you so much for your words. And I'm going to take this moment to do one of my favorite things, and that's recommend a book or two. I'm not sure if you know or have heard about, there's a book called Sarah Phillips by Andrea Lee. And I was attracted to the book for a number of reasons. That name was one of them. But Andrea Lee's book, Sarah Phillips, is a story about a young African-American woman who was the first black student to go to a school, an all-girls day school. And then also Lorraine Carey's Black Ice, which speaks to the story and the sentiment so well, which really a piece that inspired me to do my work. I have had those experiences. I remember, you know, my school was 150-plus years, and I remember looking at the first picture of a graduating class and thinking, like, wow, what would those people think about me if I had to interact with them? Hmm. You know, that's a really powerful moment for a student to think, I'm sitting the same desks that some of these folks sat in, because Quaker schools keep furniture for a long time.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in the same desks, walking in the same halls, and what would their experience be like if they were to interact with me? And also, mm-hmm.
They were all male too. I'm guessing that first class.
No, there
were women back.
It was Quaker. Yeah, it was mixed. It was probably a good 50-50.
Okay.
You know, back.
So they were progressive
days.
In that sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But exactly, they had women in the school. Jacob, let me ask you, there's a scene in the Andre's film about at the prep school where they have a black table at the lunchroom where all the African-Americans sit together. And this one young woman decided she didn't want to sit there, and she felt bad. She took grief because she didn't want to sit at the black table. Was there a black table at the Wellington School?
There was a black table at the Wellington School, and there still is, as far as I know, when I visited during break. And I think this is something that we see not only in the lunchroom, but also in many other aspects of society with this self-segregation. Mm-hmm. Currently at Duke, there's a huge conversation going on right now about African-American and Latino recruitment weekends that are separate from the general Duke student body recruitment weekend. So this is the same theme of this self-segregation. And although, you know, we're past the Jim Crow and the 1960s eras of racism, is this self-segregation, is this racism on the behalf of African-Americans and Latinos? Mm-hmm. I currently did not sit at the black table at Wellington. One, because I had a variety of friends. I did get a little bit of, pressure sometimes in that, especially because a number of my teammates that were on the basketball team sat at that table. But, I mean, this is a theme that we're seeing not only in the lunchroom but all over, even mm-hmm. currently on Duke's campus.
Yeah. Robert Brisk, the head of the Wellington School, do you watch out for that? Cliques are a part of high school, and groups are a part of high school, whether it's the black table, the jock table, the geek table. How do you combat that? self-segregation.
I think one of the things that you would see at Wellington, I think Jacob would agree, is that there's a lot of fluidity and that there's a great deal of movement. But we don't have all the answers, mm-hmm. and we continue to do what we are really trying to do. And one of the reasons we have Andre here with us is to get involved in the discussion. Part of what we're doing today at the school, while I'm here, is that we are having our first mission day. And one of the real themes is the students talking with each other about what they want the community to be and how they can make that happen. For us, it's a long-term set of discussions as we try to work through these complicated issues.
Mm-hmm. And if I could jump in really sure. quickly about the Black Table, because I've been very curious about it and paying attention to it. Today, this visit will be number 17 and 18 for showings of the movie around the country.
You've traveled to other schools like the Wellington School.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and I do Harvard on Friday, the big mm-hmm. kahuna. Which
yeah. Wellington fun. And Harvard, that sounds about right.
Same week.
So I've had so many discussions about the Black Table sort of situation, and I want to pick up on something Jacob said and think about the phrase that we're using in terms of the self-segregation, because sometimes we look at the Black Table and we make a really big deal out of it. And sometimes it's just lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just lunch. Just look around the room and see where other people are sitting. And when do we question mm-hmm. the whole division? In my personal opinion, I think it is a mistake to, when groups outside look at events like a group that recruit Black people, Latino people, and ignore the history that's attached to the reason mm-hmm. that moment exists.
But that girl was in tears. To her, it was yeah. more than just lunch when she decided not to sit at that table and took grief for it.
It was more than just lunch, but the thing mm-hmm. about her tears, if you really pull apart the whole discussion, was her whole issue was, because this is a young girl in the movie who was yeah. in tears, who's from a well-to-do family, mm-hmm. and she was having trouble fitting with the Black people. The white folks didn't understand, and then she was told she wasn't Black enough. You know, it's crazy and wild peer mm-hmm. pressure. That's high school. And the I think the real moment, the real reason this was so intense is she didn't have anyone to talk to about mm-hmm. these situations with. And I'm not fighting against, I'm not fighting for the Black Table. I'm fighting for people being able to choose and sit where they want to sit in the cafeteria, and mm-hmm. that we think about how we identify it. Mm-hmm. And you're right to point out her tears. It was a really hard, difficult moment yeah. for her. But the reason for including that in there was, like, we needed to hear that story to begin the healing process.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Yamani, you're on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you so much for taking my call. We are a first-generation immigrant family from Sri Lanka, and I have three children. Two of them currently at St. Michael's, and my son moved from St. Michael's in Worthington to Columbus Academy beginning of this academic year. And I have nothing but the most positive experience for all my children, you know, at St. Michael's and Columbus Academy, you know. Especially St. Michael's doesn't have a whole lot of diversity, you know, in terms of it's a small school and, you know, few colored children, you know, but they have always been most inclusive. And they have really had a very positive experience all along. And my son, who moved into the middle of sixth grade, similarly, I mean, he assimilated so well within a couple of days and a couple of weeks, and he's really enjoying, you know, being at Columbus Academy. And I was reading this weekend, you know, a book from Soledad O'Brien, and it was almost stunning, you know. She went to a Smithtown, you know, a public school in Long Island. And she said her siblings and she were like the only colored children there. And she obviously didn't come across as somebody who had a very positive memory of, you know, her school experience. And this is, you know, not so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay. Thank you, Yamani. Appreciate the call. Let's go to another call. Jonathan, you're on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Hi, Jonathan. You there?
Oh, yes, I am.
Go ahead.
First of all, I feel like I'm older than everybody there. I'm Jewish and went to school in the 60s. And my question mainly is, I've seen a lot of the diversity movement, and I think it's been terrific. But my question is, if as we go further, is there a challenge to, in trying to be too diverse, to avoid homogeneity, such as, you know, making all the everybody fit into the same kind of mold? Mm-hmm. Because when I went to school, you know, they tried to turn me from Jewish into something else. And I can't help but alluding to a Ursula K. Le Guin book from years ago, Lathe of Heaven, where in one of the scenes, everyone turns gray because Everyone has gone to the same places, even though they started out from diverse backgrounds. They've gone to the same places, done the same things, learned the same type of methods of society. Now there aren't as many differences and, let's say, personal characteristics as there used to be. Is that a challenge yet? Is that a concern? Is that, or am I way off base?
Well, Andre, you touched on that you shouldn't try to fit in as much as you may want to. You should hang on to your heritage. But it's, as we become a more inclusive society, is there a danger in homogeneity?
Well, the issue, and Jonathan, thank you for mentioning Ursula K. Le Guin. I love her. I think the issue that needs to be talked about when it comes to the homogeneity and everyone fitting into a mold is oftentimes, and this goes back to the discussion about white privilege, that there is one mold that the majority has created and holds. And if you don't fit into that, you're problematic and you're difficult. And finding your own individual experience within that is important and needs to be acknowledged. I am for the diversity conversation. I've been someone who's like against like the diversity day.
Yeah.
I'm saying what can we do to make this just a part of our conversation in general? Because it's closer to that.
Robert Brisk, head of the Langdon School, you're nodding as well.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think the job of education, and particularly our focus at Wellington, is to find that which is unique in every student and to give them room to pursue that. And I think that's how we stay away from homogeneity. But it does make me nervous in a society in which standardization and standardized testing tend to be more and more, particularly in the public schools, what measures student performance. So our commitment has always been to try to help students to find that which is unique and to help them fulfill their promise in that area.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. My thanks to Jacob Robinson at Duke University. Good luck in your future studies down there. Jacob, you still there?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I would just like to once again thank Wellington and my family and God for all the opportunities that I was able that I'm able to accomplish. So thank you.
All right, Jacob, thank you. Robert Brisk, head of the Wellington School, thanks very much for joining us. And Andre Robert Lee, the producer of the film The Prep School Negro. Again, it will be shown at the Wellington School, a free public showing at 6:30 tonight. Seating is limited, so the school asks that you check out their website, the Wellington School's website, to get information. But thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.